Hey, it's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we talk to a political writer who says that funding cuts to the UW system, particularly the UW Extension, have hurt what it means to be a Wisconsinite.
First, in 1789, there has been an appointed chaplain in the U.S. House of Representatives. The chaplain delivers a prayer before each day's proceedings.
Since its establishment, there have been 60 official chaplains and numerous guest chaplains who are invited to deliver prayers before the U.S. House.
Here's an example of some of the invocations you may hear on the House floor.
Our Father in heaven, we thank you for a brand new day, for all the opportunities and possibilities that come with this day. We thank you for another opportunity to be better. Thank you for the blessed opportunity to
do better. Our respective faiths remind us that the measure of society is how we treat the most vulnerable, the orphan, the widow, the stranger in our midst. God bless the members of this House.
Today, I lift up a prayer to each member of the Congress, and I ask you to give them the wisdom they need to govern and pass laws in favor of your people.
Those are just a sampling of addresses given by rabbis, pastors, preachers, and so on, who are sponsored by members of Congress to deliver the opening invocation before House sessions.
But one organization says that one of its members, a former pastor, was denied the ability to deliver a secular invocation to the House of Representatives because the applicant is an atheist.
Now, the Madison-based Freedom from Religion Foundation is suing on behalf of its co-president, who was denied the ability to speak before the House.
Dan Barker is the co-president of the Freedom from Religion Foundation and applied to deliver the invocation. He joins us now to talk about the lawsuit. Dan, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, happy to be here. I love your show.
Thank you so much. Well, in your words, why are you and the Freedom from Religion Foundation suing the House chaplain and by extension Paul Ryan and some of the chaplain staff?
I would love nothing more than to be able to participate in my government by solemnizing this very venerable act, a session of Congress, with words of encouragement and words to the higher power of we the people. And just like some of these other invocations that you heard, we atheists and agnostics also believe in the values of this country and the values of morality and equality and fairness. And Representative Pocan asked the chaplains to allow me to give a secular invocation. And after about a two-year saga, the chaplain officially turned me down.
Did Representative Pocan solicit you, or did you seek him out to ask to do this?
It was both. We know each other. He's our representative here in Madison, so he's a friend. And about 2 years ago, two of our attorneys happened to be in D.C. and just dropped in on the chaplain's office and spoke with some of the staff there, who did not say no, but who presented three requirements for someone to be able to give the be a guest chaplain for the secular invocation.
And what were those three things?
You have to be invited by a member of the House, which is how we then contacted Pocan and said, look, if in order for me to do it, the chaplain serves there as at the pleasure of the House members. So Pocan said, sure, you're in my district. I represent you. And the Freedom from Religion Foundation is an established, well-known institution here. The second is that you have to be ordained, as what they said. And the third is that you cannot address the members of the House. You must address a higher power. So I basically met all three of those, although we have subsequently found out that the chaplain does not require other guest chaplains to meet all of those requirements.
Did you see these three requirements in writing?
No, it was just that she told us that, and there's nothing in writing, actually. The two Roman Catholic staff members who work for the Jesuit chaplain basically told Sam Grover, Andrew Seidel, our attorneys, that these were the requirements.
So one of them that you mentioned was invoking a higher power. How did you do that, being an atheist?
Well, there are tens of millions of good Americans who do not believe in a supernatural higher power. But we can invoke a higher power of reason, for example. And in the United States of America, in the draft remarks that I presented to the chaplain, basically points out that in this country, there is no higher power than we, the people. We are a proudly rebellious country. We fought a Revolutionary War to kick out the sovereign, the king, the lord, the master. The only higher power we have in this country is we, the people. So I can address that higher power.
And so obviously that's open to interpretation if you're a person of organized religious faith, say the Catholic Church, that's not going to be the same definition of a higher power. I mean, are you willing to debate that?
Well, exactly. And our question is, how can a government official be deciding who is in and who is out? Who has the correct religious views? Who has the correct interpretation of a higher power and who doesn't? He's an officer of a secular Congress, and there should be no religious test for public office, our Constitution says. So he might have an idea of what a higher power is, but it's not his business to dictate to the rest of us what we must think about religious or philosophical matters.
Now, you were asked to submit your remarks. As you said, this unfolded over the course of 2 years. Can you tell us some about, putting aside the higher power, what you were planning to say had you been permitted to give the invocation?
Yes. I was going to say that America is becoming much more diverse. Right now, Christianity is about 70%, although about 97% of the prayers have been Christian prayers over this time. The fastest growing religion, I put that word in quotes, the fastest growing religion in the United States right now is non-religion, including tens of millions of atheists and agnostics who do not believe that there is a higher spirit, higher spiritual power. But in my remarks, I plan to say, if he'll let me do this, we can invoke the spirit, in quotes, the spirit of founding father and founding patriot Thomas Paine, for example, who is very anti-Christian, very deistic, or the spirit of Thomas Jefferson, or the spirit of freedom and liberty and justice for all. Those kinds of spirits we non-believers can invoke, and why not? This is our country, and our Congress would be better off with that viewpoint represented in those halls.
Do you think that what you had intended to say was in keeping with the intention of the invocation at each day's beginning of Congress?
Yes, it is, because the whole intention of the invocation is to solemnize the proceedings. And we atheists and agnostics can certainly solemnize. I'm still using my Christian ordination to perform weddings and memorial services, and they know that I'm an atheist, and yet my performance at these services, in fact, the chaplain of the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs allowed me to perform a non-religious wedding at that military base. And it was solemnizing a very important event. So, yes, we think the government would be better off by allowing the views of good atheists and agnostics and pointing out the diversity in our country.
We're talking with Dan Barker right now, co-president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. And he's talking with us because he was recently denied, is that right? I mean, the lawsuit is recent, but
the lawsuit was this week. We filed on the National Day of Prayer, and the denial was in January. The official written denial was in January.
So we're talking about this denial to lead an invocation at the House of Representatives on the grounds. What were the grounds? Because you were an atheist, because you did not invoke the higher power?
Well, because in the denial, the chaplain said that my ordination is no longer valid because I am no longer a true minister of the gospel. Since I changed my views, suddenly my ordination to solemnize ceremonies is no longer valid. So to us, that means that he doesn't like atheists. To us, it means that he thinks there's a supernatural higher power that must be invoked rather than the real world higher power that we non-believers should invoke and should govern our daily lives.
So this lawsuit you have going forward, what are the grounds?
Well, we're suing on the Establishment Clause, that his actions are respecting an establishment of religion. We're suing under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which places an undue burden on my exercise of religion as a non-religious person. And the First Amendment, of course, uses that word religion to include non-religion. It's not just freedom of religion, but it's freedom from religion. We're suing under the constitutional prohibition against a religious test for public office. So a guest chaplain would be a public office, and yet putting a religious test on that violates our Constitution.
And a representative from Speaker Ryan's office, now he's part of this group that you're suing, he told our producer earlier in an email that, quote, "We do not believe that the case has merit, and we anticipate moving to dismiss it soon," end quote. So what are you hoping to accomplish?
Well, even if they do move to dismiss, they're agreeing that their officer in the secular Congress is discriminating. They think they have the freedom and the right to discriminate against good Americans who don't share the religious views of the majority. So we're hoping at least to point out the fact that our government is discriminating against a good segment, a fast-growing segment of the population. What we really want is to be allowed, for any atheist to be allowed. For centuries, for many, many decades, no atheists have ever been allowed to address Congress. In fact, Ernestine L. Rose, back in the 1800s, was barred from addressing Congress because she was an open feminist atheist.
And I suppose it's worth pointing out that in this group you're talking about, the people who identify as nuns, there are a large group of people who identify as having some spirituality.
Yeah, nuns, like N-O-N-E.
Right, and it's not just atheists and...
Exactly.
It's a different group of people that we're seeing come up.
At least half of them are atheists and agnostics.
And I want to just ask you briefly, are you opposed to this entire practice of the invocation, or would you just like to be included as part of it for atheists?
Most of our members are opposed, like James Madison was opposed to congressional chaplains, but we're not challenging the chaplaincy itself right now in this lawsuit.
And we'll leave it there. Dan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Speaking there with Dan Barker, co-president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, he joined us to talk about having his application denied to deliver a secular invocation to the House of Representatives by the Office of the Chaplain, and his organization is filing a lawsuit.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up on Food Friday, we'll learn how to choose and prepare healthy and delicious salmon dishes.
First, $250 million in state funding was cut from the UW system in the latest budget. Those cuts affected four-year colleges around the state and also meant a loss of $3.6 million in funding for the UW Extension.
And our next guest says cutting funding from the UW Extension did more than lower its annual budget. It was also a blow to the ideas Wisconsin was built on, including the Wisconsin idea that the boundaries of the university are the boundaries of the state.
An initial draft of the budget changed the language of the university mission statement from an effort to extend knowledge and its application beyond the boundaries of its campus and to serve and stimulate society, with a new goal to meet the state's workforce needs.
The UW Extension is responsible for broadcast operations, and in the interests of disclosure, that includes WPR. It also provides online degrees and works with Wisconsin's 72 counties on parenting, agriculture and economic development issues.
Joining us now is Charles P. Pierce. He's the lead writer for Esquire.com's politics blog, where he recently published the article, "Scott Walker Has Destroyed What It Means to Be a Wisconsinite." Charles, welcome to the show.
No problem.
Well, why focus, among all the changes that have happened in Wisconsin over the last 5 years or so, why did UW Extension and the cuts there get your attention?
Well, I mean, I've been writing ever since I started the blog, which happened to be in October of 2011, on what's going on in Wisconsin and the use of Wisconsin, the state of Wisconsin, as kind of a lab rat for all these, experiments in extremist conservative government. So I've written about the voter laws and the uprising on the lawn of the Capitol and the transformation of Wisconsin into a right to work state. So this was just the latest manifestation of it. Of course, it has a tremendous. I lived for 5 years in Milwaukee, so I'm familiar with Wisconsin and its political history. To me, this was just an incredibly vivid example of the attack on the Wisconsin political tradition and what we all know is the Wisconsin idea. So that's what brought it to my attention and made it worth blogging about.
And why is UW Extension, as you see it, such a key part of the Wisconsin idea?
Well, because the Wisconsin idea was a natural outgrowth of the land-grant college system, which for us was first started during the Civil War in the 1860s and then promoted through the Smith-Lever Act later and so on and so forth, whereby the brain power of a university could be put to good use for the citizens, whether or not they went to the college or not. And the extension, of course, the extension service was the manifestation of that idea to the rural communities. The extension service is a triumph of big government. So I have a feeling that's why it was target A.
And you focused in on sort of the day-to-day experience of extension, that piece you wrote, talking about people finding out how this might affect things like 4-H, things that they might not have associated with the state budget or with the university system.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the extension service touched so many lives in so many different ways that it became sort of, a fact of life for people that they took for granted, and they didn't realize. I think they realized it, but they lost touch with the fact that it touched so many different parts of their lives, especially in small towns.
So this is in a way a trickle down of these state budget cuts that were in all the headlines that people didn't necessarily see in their day to day lives.
Sure, because the mainstream media, because of a lot of reasons that we don't need to get into here, concentrates mainly on how the sausage gets made in the state capitol. But there's often very little follow-through unless people in the various communities raise hell about it.
Why do you see this as such a loss for Wisconsin and the unique identity of Wisconsin?
Well, because we have had a general assault over the past 30 years against the idea of a political commonwealth, against the idea that we own things in common in this country. And I think that, you know, Wisconsin was the leader in promoting that idea in the turn of the 19th into the 20th century. Between President Bascom at the university and Governor La Follette, and on and on and on, it was the place where a lot of these ideas were road tested, everything from the direct election of senators to the extension service. And I think that I think as the place where these ideas got road tested, it became a test case for rolling all of this stuff back. And you hear a lot of talk about rolling back the achievements of the 1960s. These are people who want to roll back the achievements of the 1890s.
Are other states watching us here in Wisconsin, seeing how this plays out, either drawing inspiration?
I don't think there's any doubt. I think certainly the developments in North Carolina, are a direct result of the success that Governor Walker's had in Wisconsin. I think John Kasich tried it in Ohio, but he tried to enact the same law about public sector unions in Ohio, but Ohio had a provision where you could put it on the ballot, and he put it on the ballot, and he got his butt kicked around the block by the people of Ohio, and that's the only reason they don't have it right now. So, yes, I think there's been a concerted effort. I think the most graphic and gory and garish and awful example is Kansas.
Talking to Charles P. Pierce, lead writer for Esquire.com's political blog, talking about his piece, Scott Walker has destroyed what it means to be a Wisconsinite. You mentioned, Charles, rolling back the 1960s, even the 1890s in Wisconsin. Has something fundamental changed about Wisconsin that allowed those changes, as you say, pioneered here, to be some of the first that are rolled back in the country?
Yeah, I left Wisconsin in 1977, so I'm doing this basically third-hand and through people that I know who stayed there and worked. I talked to a couple of Republicans, Tommy Thompson-era Republicans in Wisconsin, when I was up there for the primary. And they said that when Thompson left, when Thompson, you know, finished up being governor and then left and became he was a cabinet secretary under the first President Bush, the leadership void in the Wisconsin Republican Party was filled by really conservative people, much more conservative even than Tommy Thompson was. And Tommy Thompson was a Reaganite before it was popular. And what happened was you wound up with an extremely radicalized Republican Party. And at that point, you know, the techniques of conservative movement conservative campaigns came into the state and were remarkably successful. And I think that was the beginning of the transformation to what we see now.
But can't we say that to some extent the people of Wisconsin are embracing this message? Governor Walker's won three elections?
No, I don't know. I tend to, people will say he was elected three times in 2 years. I tend to put the recall outside of that because, a lot of the recall vote near Zagatel was against the idea of the recall, but he was reelected. I don't ever, in anything I write, take voters off the hook for the unintended consequences of what happens when they cast their votes or don't cast their votes. I think we do, in fact, in this country, get the government we deserve, and to an extent, the government we ask for.
So, why are people asking for that government here?
I have no idea. I don't think many of them are right now. I don't think you'll see the governor run for re-election. I'd be very surprised if he did. That having been said, on the state legislative level, it's still it's a hard road to push. It's a hard road to push up the hill. There are a lot of dynamics going on. And some of which I find inexplicable.
Some critique in the state of the Democratic Party saying even if you don't like the Republicans' message, they have a clear and cohesive message. Democrats, a lot of people are saying, don't. They haven't provided a viable alternative except anti-Walker.
True. I mean, I think that at least from the outside, the Democratic Party in Wisconsin has been very slow to respond to exactly how radical a conservative Governor Walker is. His friends in the radical conservatives Governor Walker and his friends in the legislature are. Certainly they've come to know it now, And, you know, we'll see what happens going forward.
I saw a quote, I think it was from Grover Norquist, the national conservative activist advocate, saying Governor Walker came in and he did the ceiling of what we could hope for from a conservative governor. Now that represents, he says, the floor for governors in other states and for potential Republican presidential candidates. Has he changed Governor Walker, the national conversation?
I think he probably already did, but I can't imagine, given what's going on in Kansas, where, and I would argue with Grover Norquist that Governor Walker has not in any way come in and established a ceiling. What's going on in Kansas is an utter disaster, and it's far beyond even what Governor Walker's done. So I would say Governor Brownback is probably as far as you can. I mean, hope is as far as you can go. And all we can hope for is the Democrats get smart enough to swing the pendulum back in the other direction.
We'll leave it there for now. Charles, thanks a lot for taking the time.
Thanks a lot. It's good to talk to folks in Wisconsin.
That was Charles P. Pierce, lead writer for Esquire.com's politics blog.
Coming up after the news, it's time for Food Friday, and we're going to learn how to cook some great salmon dishes, also how to prepare the salmon and learn about the different types of salmon, because it turns out there's a lot of them. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we recap the biggest stories from around the state this week in our Wisconsin News Roundup.
First, salmon is the third most popular seafood eaten in North America, and our guest on today's edition of Food Friday is a Major League salmon fan. She has ideas for cooking salmon on the stove, in the oven, on the grill, or not cooking it at all.
Diane Morgan joins us now. She's a James Beard Award-winning cookbook author, food writer, and recipe developer. Her new book is called Salmon, Everything You Need to Know, Plus 45 Recipes. Diane, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you.
Well, it seems like you don't just kind of like salmon. It seems like you're in love with salmon. Why are you so into the fish?
I feel good eating it. I love how delicious it is in so many different preparations. It's just an all-around, you know, health booster and health and wellness booster, and just the delight of cooking it in the kitchen. I truly can eat it for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I had some for breakfast this morning, and I'm having it for dinner tonight.
Well, that's something I took away from your book. It's really versatile. Why, you can do just about anything with salmon.
Right. You can, if you love a tartare preparation, you can do salmon tartare. If you like ceviche, you can make salmon ceviche. If you have the simplest of kitchens and the most basic cooking skills, you can put it in a low oven and turn out a beautiful piece of fish. So it's just so versatile that way. You know, for backyard barbecue enthusiasts, you've got it made. You can grill it. You can plank it. You can smoke it. It's just ideal.
You said you had it for breakfast and you're going to have it for dinner. What recipes did you have for breakfast and what's up for dinner?
For breakfast, I actually had a gravlax style that I did in the book. I had done a filet last week. And so I just had a goat cheese schmear on a toasted grainy loaf and laid some salmon on top of it. And for dinner, I'm actually going to slow roast it, and I have some, it's sort of a play on a couple of recipes in the book. I'm slow roasting it. There was some gorgeous local asparagus in the market, so I'm going to do that with just a little bit of a butter glaze over the top.
Before we get into some specific recipes, you give a lot of basics in the book about selecting and preparing salmon. So let's say we're at the store. What are we looking for in a good salmon to prepare?
Well, we're coming into salmon season now. You know, most of the wild-caught salmon coming in the markets these days will be coming out of Alaska. The season's going to start in about 2 weeks. And you're going to see lots of beautiful sockeye fillets in the market to begin with, and then some kings, and later in the season you're going to go into the silver coho salmon. So the big fish that's filled with the omega-3s and that really gorgeous salmon color that we all know, that's what's coming into the market in, you know, shortly. So I think it's really important to understand that salmon has a season, just like asparagus or strawberries or peaches, and that's when the best prices are available to the consumer. And year-round, there is nothing wrong with flash frozen salmon that you can buy. And to, you know, to fully complement what's in the market, you're going to see farm salmon. And my best suggestion is to put on your cell phone the app from the Monterey Bay Seafood Watch Program. You download the app, you plug in salmon, and you will see all the fish that are good to eat, the ones to be concerned about and others to avoid. It's really straightforward.
Well, let's say you do that, and that's the Monterey Bay Aquarium app for fish. So they're going to check it out ahead of time and let you know if it's sustainable and whether you should pick something else to be more responsible. But let's say you've got one that is on their recommended list. What do you recommend personally for taste?
Well, my top of my list will always be wild-caught salmon. And the abundance is coming out of Alaska, so look for that. I was actually at a market yesterday, and I'm sure the guy thought I was sort of a competitor to their store, but I was taking pictures of what was in the case because I just wanted to really get the full breadth and kind of check it against the Monterey Bay app. And there was a farm salmon from Iceland. And it was something that, you know, I'm going to research a little bit more because that's typically farmed in open ocean pens. And it may or may not be best practices. I need to read more about it, just in terms of Iceland itself. So it's really important for the consumer to know what they're buying, make friends with the fishmonger behind the case, ask questions, and just learn a little bit more about it.
Talking to Diane Morgan, her new book is Salmon, Everything You Need to Know, plus 45 recipes. In a lot of the preparation, when you're talking fillets, you say, hey, get that out of the refrigerator about half an hour or so before you start cooking. Why is that?
Just don't want it stone cold. It's like any protein, that just getting that refrigerator chill off of it just makes it easier to cook because it's not refrigerator cold. So that for me follows through with fish as well. And a half hour is plenty of time to take off the chill, but not be in any way in a danger zone of growing bacteria.
Let's get into a couple of the recipes that you shared with us, and these are up on the Central Time Facebook page right now. And I want to start with one for slow cooked salmon with spring vegetables. Tell us about this. This isn't a slow cooker recipe; it's just cooked slowly. But how does this one go?
You set your oven to 250 degrees. You line a rim baking sheet with some foil, and the only reason for that is just to save some cleanup. And I typically do this with center cut fillets that are a little bit thicker. You know, 5 or 6 ounces is a plenty size for a individual portion. And in this case, I remove the skin and I remove the pin bones. You can remove pin bones with a needle nose plier. I have one dedicated to the kitchen, so it doesn't go from the workshop to the kitchen. And if you want, you can ask the person behind the fish case to take off the skin for you if you don't want to do that. And I rub it with a little bit of olive oil, sprinkle it with lightly with some sea salt, some black pepper, a pinch of cayenne. And I am slow roasting it in the oven. So once you've seasoned it and rubbed it with a little oil, it goes into the oven. And while it's cooking, which takes about 20 to 25 minutes, you are par cooking some little carrots. You're blanching some asparagus spears that I've cut into 2-inch lengths. And you're peas. You're just blanching the peas, mm-hmm. too. And then I'm making a really light white wine butter sauce. Really light, doesn't take away from the fish. And that's all gets plated with the fish in the center, the cooked vegetables scattered around the side, and spooned over top is this lovely light white wine sauce.
Diane, you know, when I cook with a lot of kinds of meat, I'm worried about undercooking. With fish, I'm paranoid that I'm going to overcook it. How do I make sure, regardless of the preparation style, that I'm not overcooking my salmon?
Well, one of the best tools for your kitchen is an instant read thermometer. And it's, you know, they're about $10. And it's, I actually prefer the analog type to the digital type. And it's a great tool, whether you're cooking a steak or whether you're cooking a piece of salmon. And my recommendation is to cook your salmon to about 118 to 120 degrees. You know, once you get above 125, you're starting to get on the overcooked side. At 120, it's just flaking beautifully. It's really moist. It's perfect.
What is your favorite preparation? If you had just an old standby, maybe you wanted to have some people over for dinner, so it shouldn't be too simple, but it should still be something that you can return to again and again and not get tired of. What's your favorite preparation?
It truly is like, you know, picking your favorite child. It's hard. It's... In the summer, I love to grill outside, so putting salmon on a plank is really fun. You get this lovely smoky flavor. It's as easy as slow roasting because it's if you soak the plank ahead of time so it doesn't burn up on the grill, you lay the salmon on it. You don't need to take the skin off. It's really nice to remove the pin bones. And it's the same thing, a little bit of olive oil, a little bit of seasoning, and on the plank, and it smoke grills on the grill, and it's fabulous. It's easy. It's big flavor, and then from there you can add a, you know, any side sauce you want, anything from barbecue sauce to a mango salsa, really up for grabs. But that's the basic, probably all-time favorite.
We're talking right now with Diane Morgan about her new book, Salmon, Everything You Need to Know, Plus 45 Recipes. Her recipes for salmon hash with Yukon Gold potatoes and herbs are up on the Central Time Facebook page.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you like to prepare salmon? How do you like to eat salmon? Are you looking for some new ideas? Or maybe you haven't quite figured out how to make it in a way that stays moist and tasty the way you want it. Diane has some tips to share. She can help you out. Call in now at 800-642-1234 or leave a question, a comment, or your favorite recipe on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're continuing our Food Friday conversation right now with James Beard Award-winning cookbook author Diane Morgan about her new book, Salmon, Everything You Need to Know. Her recipes for slow-cooked salmon with spring vegetables and salmon hash with Yukon Gold potatoes and herbs are up on the Central Time Facebook page.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your comments. How do you like your salmon? How do you make it? What advice do you need? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll start off with Kathy in Fitchburg. Kathy, hi.
Hi. I used to be afraid to cook fish. I've never felt comfortable when it was done, how to do it, whatever. I met a guy at the Pontius Carnivore in Madison who he fishes Alaskan salmon, and he lives part-time, I think, in Verona. And the Alaskan Fisheries came out with recipes where you cook it from frozen, you put a little olive oil in a frying pan, cover it up, and you actually, the ice crystals sort of, they melt and they sort of steam the fish. And within a half an hour, like, I cannot know what I'm going to have for supper. If I have some salmon in my freezer, I can just take it out of the freezer, and I make my own preserved lemons, throw some preserved lemons on top of it, and within a half an hour, I have this really wonderful so easy dish to eat.
Kathy, thanks a lot for that call. So two thoughts there. Diane, one, know your fishmonger. And two, she talked about cooking from frozen. Do you have advice if we have that frozen salmon in the freezer and want dinner in the next hour or so?
That is a technique. I'm well aware of that technique. I didn't include it in the book, but I am well aware of that technique that they were promoting because they want people to know that fish straight out of the freezer, you don't have to have this panic that, oh, I didn't thaw anything for supper. And it does work. You know, it's not my top choice. I like to have a fish thaw slowly in the refrigerator for 24 hours so that the moisture in the fish, the cell structure doesn't break down. But it's totally viable. And yes, for those who are like, ah, what do I do for dinner? And you have frozen salmon in the freezer, lucky you, then go for it.
Well, thank you for that call. And we go next to Kim in Menominee. Hi, Kim.
Hi there. So I go up to Alaska and I fish.
Yeah.
And I typically come back with a lot, well, enough, maybe a little more than enough. And then I'm wondering, so I plank it and I do all some great recipes to start with, but what if it's a few months out? The only things I know of is I do either a stovetop smoker or, you know, grill smoker with a plank or something. Do you have any other suggestions for a few month old in the freezer dish?
Great. Thank you, Kim. And Diana, what about it? Anything else?
Yeah, that's a great question. Actually, I buy 100 pounds of salmon every summer at the height of the season, and I have it flash frozen and vacuum sealed, and so I have a freezer full, and we go through about that much in a year's time, and so there is nothing wrong if it is properly sealed to hold for a year. And so any preparation that I've come up with in the book is fine to use. It, you know, now that said, braising and creating or making a chowder is an excellent way if you have fish that to you seems older to chunk it up and toss it in a chowder. Or I have a green curry braised salmon, bringing in some global flavors to the recipes in the book. And it has snow peas, it has shiitake mushrooms, and it's fabulous. It's another way to, you know, use salmon that isn't in top-notch shape.
Hope that helps out, Kim. We are talking to Diane Morgan. Her new book is Salmon, Everything You Need to Know. We'll go back to our callers with Dan on the line in Portage. Dan, hi.
Happy Friday, everyone.
You too. What do you want to know, Dan?
I have a fiance who is a chef that does outdoor cooking, and I was wondering if the guest had a particularly successful recipe for open fire salmon, so over a flame at a campsite or with a grill, something like that.
Speaking to my heart for live fire cooking. One of the things that's great, there's a couple ways you can go. One is to get your best beat up cast iron skillet and use that and make a little, you know, put a little grate on the grill for a level surface and pan sear the salmon in the cast iron skillet that's been slick with some oil. So that's an easy way to go. Another is you can buy these grill baskets that are long in the shape of a fish, and you can do a whole fish on the grill. So you keep the head and tail on if it'll fit, and the skin, and you stuff the inside with some lemon slices and maybe some fennel slices or some fresh herbs, and you stick the fish in the grate and you cook that over the fire. And so the skin is getting charred, but the fish inside is protected, and it's another great way to go.
Dan, thanks a lot for that, and we're going to move next to Bob in Amherst Junction. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Wow, what a great topic. So I go to Alaska too, and generally during the silver season, bring home a lot of fish. But what I find here locally is more of the sockeye. And the sockeye has a different texture. It's not as firm as the fish that I catch and bring home. I don't know if it's because of the way it was prepared and frozen or if it's just the nature of that particular fish. So that's my question, but I also have a favorite recipe, which is just to pan sear in a cast iron skillet and prepare a garlic maple syrup and mustard glaze. And I found that is really popular even with young kids.
Great, Bob. Thank you so much for that. And Diane, what about the differences in texture of some of the varieties he was talking about there?
Yeah. So the silver salmon is a later fish in the runs of salmon coming through Alaska. Sockeye is the early one, and they're really, it's a thinner fish. It's higher in omega-3 fatty acids, but they're all high in omega-3s, so all good for you. And so it's really it's taking advantage of the thickness of the fish as to the best preparations. And I think planking sockeye, because of its tender flesh, is an easier and better preparation, or even slow roasting it, whereas the silvers have a little more versatility. Slightly thicker fillet, little bit firmer, so you can play with it a little bit more. And I'm all a fan of his glaze. It sounds great. I mean, I was, for the size of the book, you know, 45 recipes was what was to be included. And, you know, I could have done 145. So I love hearing all these different ideas because they're great. And I can totally see that flavor combination with the salmon.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Diane, you include recipes for using your leftover salmon. So I don't think of fish usually as great leftover fodder, but you do.
Oh, my gosh. I love, in fact, I cook extra so that I have leftovers. Potato hash with salmon. Oh, my gosh. You can't beat it for a weekend brunch. And classic preparation, except that you're flaking in salmon. And it's fabulous. Leftover salmon with pasta, leftover salmon stirred into risotto, tacos. It's you know, even a frittata, just on and on with the options for it. So cook extra. Make it easy on yourself and, you know, cook once and end up with two different meals from it.
Fantastic. Diane, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Diane Morgan. She's a James Beard Award-winning cookbook author. Her most recent cookbook is Salmon, Everything You Need to Know, plus 45 recipes. Well, we've got two of those recipes. You can find them on the Central Time Facebook page, links through to our show page. We've got those recipes up there. Let us know how they go. And we've got, what, salmon hash, Yukon Gold potatoes, and a slow-cooked salmon over on the Central Time Facebook page. Some news out this week that shoppers have been hoping for, in some cases dreading, in others. IKEA is coming to Wisconsin.
The Swedish chain is famous for its assemble-it-yourself furniture, household items, and meatballs. And the company announced yesterday that it's planning to open a store along I-94 in Oak Creek near Milwaukee.
IKEA fans don't start camping out for opening day just yet. The company's aiming for the summer of 2018 to open the doors.
That said, there's already been a lot of buzz about the announcement because it's a store that generates strong feelings, stirs up deep passions, pro and con.
Some people love IKEA. Some, I'm not a fan. It was a little overwhelming to me. There's a lot going on there. But apparently, and you were telling me this earlier, couples sometimes have real difficulties navigating IKEA
together.
It's
a real test of a relationship. If you can make it through a 2 or 3 hour trip in IKEA, you're basically good to go. You can get married, or you'll be married for the next, you know, 150 years. But, you know, if not, you know, it frays along those fault lines.
Like IKEA. Deciding what to get there, comparing and contrasting, and then assembling the furniture. These are the hurdles?
Right. These are important. Well, it's a huge store, and, you know, people can want to go their different ways. You get tired and crabby. You fight. And I could live in IKEA. I don't want to say anything against IKEA, but it does test your mettle.
A nightmare for some, a dream for others. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.